The Africa Law Tech podcast explores the latest in law technology and entrepreneurship in the African continent. This weekly podcast is brought to you by the Lawyers Hub, a law tech organization working on digital policy and justice innovation in Africa. To find out more, visit lawyershub.org or email us on info@lawyershub.ke.
Welcome everyone and thanks for joining us. I want to invite my panelists on stage. So I'll introduce everyone on the panel, what they do, and then we begin with Maurice.
My name is Andisa Ndlovu. I am a broadcast journalist and TV producer from South Africa. And yeah, I have an interest in how creatives can use technology to engage and sometimes to be a bridge, you know, between centers of information and people on the ground.
My name is Dan Aseda. I work in music and production in general. I run a little startup called Semabox, and we like to say that we are Africa's biggest podcast incubator.
My name is Wamadai, James Wamadai. I do many things, but I mean digital, digital marketing, digital publishing, digital rights, and most importantly, I work for an organization called the Bloggers Association of Kenya, and I also run a digital media startup called HyperKenya.com.
My name is James Smart. I'm a journalist. Currently, I'm the podcast editor at The Nation. I'm happy to be here and interested to share thoughts and ideas on exactly what we need to talk about with the creatives and the civic engagement space and how it should look.
Thanks, Linda, for the introduction. So I'm Maurice, executive director at Baraza Media Lab, basically an incubator for media startups who are coming up with new storytelling models as well as new business models. I think this conversation is very important but also interesting because it's changing a lot over time in terms of how you see creatives and techies basically performing their civic duties. And there's one saying that usually one of my very famous friend called Dana said that usually says, he says something like, "Msanii ni kioo cha jamii," right? So basically an artist is almost like the reflection of what you're seeing in our society. And that's why, for me, that's why they're a better place to sort of like show and even sometimes articulate some of the challenges that you're facing in the community. Normally, these conversations were left for, of course, our policymakers or even some very powerful NGOs who have time to run around in the corridors of parliament and push for policy changes and all. But of late, you've seen a lot of creatives, and tech is basically pushing the needle a little bit on that side. So for me, it's just a question that I have, and I think I'll direct it again to any of the speakers. Why do we have a lot of pressure, for example, or absurd expectations on techies and creatives to be able to advocate and speak on behalf of our citizens because of this social contract vis-a-vis compared to people that we've actually given contracts, which is the government and people that we've employed?
If I can jump in, I think it's really the fact that, yes, there's an implicit contract between people who have of a certain prominence in society to speak on behalf of those who don't have that platform. But I think with respect to creatives, is because creatives are able to articulate things in a way that touches the regular person differently from how a legislator would perhaps do his job. I think the strictures around legislation make it so that it's very removed from what the common person's experience is. So even if a legislator were to try and, you know, articulate a specific issue, it has to go through all of those rungs before it becomes, and all of that negotiation and horse trading before it becomes a law, before it takes effect. So that time lag sometimes, you know, affects the way legislators are supposed to be able to do this, the people who actually have the contracts. Whereas a singer can sing something that really captures the essence of a movement, captures the sentiment or what we're all thinking. A journalist can go out there and speak to the people who are closest to a story, who are on the sharp end of an issue. And their ability to articulate these things on behalf of other people gives them that platform. Now, does it mean that every day a singer should sing, you know, songs that are about, you know, social conflict and the kinds of things that are taking place in society? No, I don't think so. Nor should journalists also be, you know, bound on a daily basis to do those things, because there's a whole range of issues that people need to cover, and from time to time, I think it's also about how certain things affect or impact the lives of the people who are, you know, who have that platform, right? To the extent that they would then stick their necks out and talk about a specific issue. I think that's really the answer that I'd give.
I do want to say that, speaking as a person who works in the industry of music and has done these tracks, one of the things that I think is important for us to straighten out is that the responsibility for civic engagement and civic action should not be on artists, in my opinion. It should be on every citizen by virtue of them being a citizen. The opportunity for you to engage with the government and to engage with the system that we are all living in is exactly the same across whatever career somebody has chosen. So if you're an accountant or you're a lawyer, your capacity to start a movement is exactly the same as the biggest musician in the country. The difference really in terms of platforms, to borrow the word that John Allan was using, is one that I think is incidental. It is something that has occurred by virtue of the work that you do, but it is not necessarily specifically for this purpose. And I think it's important for us not to give this responsibility to just one person because of the job that they do. Remember, for you to actually engage in civic action, it's a matter of personal risk and a matter of personal feeling, you know. Some musicians, and I would defend their right to do this, some musicians actually don't want to participate in civic action. So, and that's a similar position that any other regular citizen would take. So I don't believe that we should kind of force them to do it. I think we should allow them to find the awareness for themselves, and then maybe they can raise their voice for it. But it's important for the opportunity to be as open as possible to everybody, and maybe artists would, whoever, you know, feels like they have something to add to the conversation should add it. Whenever you look at historically, places where the musicians and artists have been most effective in giving power to a movement is when they felt strongly about the issue, not when they were paid to produce a song. And this distinction is really important. We are very well practiced in communication. We have very well developed skills in how to move mood, how to affect even your mood every day. That's what we do every day. So we can actually sing about an issue but not care about it. And then in that case, I don't feel that the engagement is genuine and that it will move the needle in the direction that we need to move.
Thank you very much. I was going to say about when Dan spoke, you know, we go to a tailor and ask them to make a dress for us, and it doesn't matter whether the tailor is filling your dress or not, he'll just make it. And even for political, you know, seasons, and I'll give an example in Kenya. We had the song by, what's this guy's name? Tano Tena. You know, and then people come in, they dance to the song, people win the election, and then everybody's coming back to bash him for the kind of songs that he's singing. But he's just doing a gig, you know. And, you know, I don't know how we separate lawyers maybe doing transactions and getting, you know, getting involved in money laundering. Then they would say, you know what, the lawyer was just doing maybe their job. We don't give the same grace to, you know, musicians and techies, for instance. And I liked what Boni put on his status, that in terms of automated elections and, you know, elections on digital platforms, it takes a techie to steal an election. If you look at maybe the other elections we've had in Kenya, those percentages that don't just go away and remain the same are actually set, that algorithm is set by a techie. So where do you draw the line and say, this is my job and then this is my conscience? But then also too, and I'm really curious to hear about, do we move in a pack? Do we move as individuals? However much people love you for your music, it's like if you stick out as a, like a sore thumb, eventually they don't listen to you anymore, because the incumbent will just figure out a way of dealing with you from, you know, as, from a creative side. I don't know if there's any reactions to this and any points that come across from the discussion.
So this is Melissa Zisengwe from the Civic Tech Innovation Network. But I would like to start with responding to Dan. I think he raised quite a, I don't know how to put it, it was a difficult question to answer, but why do people look to techies to solve our problems? And I think the simple answer to that is that everyone has been trained to think that technology and innovations are the solutions to all our problems. I work in the civic tech community, so I see that everyone from Kenya to Nigeria to South Africa to Kenya, they are doing so many stuff to solve African problems. But the problem is, with all these technological solutions that everyone is creating, the problem always comes back to the government or whatever social issue on the ground. So if perhaps there's no buy-in from the community or the government, the technology solution doesn't actually make much difference because no one is going to use it. No one knows about it. So I think it's more than just about using technology to, you know, achieve something, to fight injustice. It's more than that. It has got to be combined with other on-the-ground efforts. It's not just, well, I've got this app idea and we can create it and people can vote online, blah, blah, blah. It's more than that. And I also wanted to speak to the whole journalist thing because I think it caught me because I am a journalist by profession. Well, I was. But I think I agree with Mo because it's like when you become a doctor, when you sign up to do that and you study to do that, you are actually signing up to heal people, to do that job. So same as a journalist, people look to you to provide stories, real, truthful, factual stories, because that's what you've signed up to do as a journalist. If you're wearing that badge, you are saying, I will provide you with all the stories. I will fight to get all the information that you deserve to know as a citizen. So I think it's not just saying that we are looking to them to tell us the story. It's that social contract exists, and it's just that everyone in society has a part to play, and that the part for journalists is a very big one, unfortunately. So they are always in the play whenever something happens.
So I was just going to add to that I'm surprised that techies are asking if they should engage, you know, if there should be civic engagement, because how exactly are you going to run a business, a tech business, anywhere on the continent without you having to engage in the civic space? It's almost impossible, right? And you know, nobody's saying you should carry a placard, but it depends on where you sit. Your advocacy doesn't necessarily mean carrying a placard to the streets. It could also be, you know, making sure that you are on roundtable discussions with policymakers, because we are at the point where the continent in itself is evolving just like tech is evolving as well, right? So that sort of that development is happening simultaneously, which is very different from, say, countries like the US, who have probably dealt with a lot of the issues that we're currently dealing with many years ago, right? So that sort of like symbiotic relationship between economic independence, which is what I would call the kind of growth we're seeing on the African continent right now, and technology evolution is not really happening in the same way. So because of the way things are happening, like we had a conversation in my firm today, and then we're talking about franchising, and then we realized that very few countries on the continent actually have legislations that speak to franchising in itself, right? And that is such a big part of intellectual property growth and licensing and all of that in different developed economies, right? So that's a conversation that we're just starting to have. So as someone who operates in the tech space, you are at the point where you're shaping policy, right? And whether you like it or not, if you don't participate, you're going to get to a point where you just wake up one day and your business is illegal, like for no reason, right? So you want to be able to. So, I mean, maybe with creatives, we can still have that conversation about the fact that there's a social contract. But for techies, I think there's a fiduciary duty to your investors for you to make sure that you're participating in the civic space somehow, because whether you like it or not, you know, public policy and regulation risk is a live risk. It's like a live wire for you in your business. So I don't even know why that should even be a conversation that we're saying maybe, maybe not. That's where I sit, really. I think that, you know, regulatory risk is such a very big thing for you as a tech company operating in most countries on the continent. And you should start thinking about what your strategy is. It doesn't necessarily have to be pulling a placard, but you need to have that engagement strategy with policymakers.
I wanted to say that I think one of the first things that they teach you in journalism school is the whole idea and concept of objectivity, that you should be objective, you must take no sides. I, however, think that the idea of objectivity is a bit of a myth, because by virtue of having been born a girl in a village in the Eastern Cape in South Africa, there's a way in which I look at life that will be completely different from, say, a white male who was born and raised in Sandton, for instance. And so my approach to how I cover anything is always on two things. Accuracy: am I sharing information that is accurate? And secondly, is my analysis of what is going on fair? So for me, those two things: are you accurate? Are you fair? I don't penalize people around objectivity, because, you know, by virtue of how you were raised and where you are in the world, you will look at things based on just your outlook, right? And so living in South Africa, we're living in interesting times. Access to internet, access to social media, where the audiences we are giving information to are not passive. They are active partakers in the information that we are giving out. So you're talking to people who have an idea of what is going on and who can analyze the situation for themselves. So if you are unfairly taking sides, people can see. If you are pushing a certain agenda, people can see. I mean, in South Africa at the moment, we have a very obvious mistrust between people on the ground and what is out there in the media. We have debates around whether or not journalists are taking sides in certain things. Are they trying to push a narrative of a certain faction of the ruling party? Are they pro Jacob Zuma? Are they pro Cyril Ramaphosa? There's all those things. However, I think that the journalists who are more concerned about putting information there that is credible and accurate, information out there, who analyze what is going on fairly, are the people that are generally trusted by audiences. And with regards to, you know, what do you do at a protest? I think it's not your job to really blatantly take a side. People decide for themselves if you give them credible and information that they can actually use. You at a protest, you tell people stories. Why are you here? What does being here mean for you? And let the audience decide for themselves what they do with that information. I don't think that it is our job to, you know, sway people towards a particular direction. And I think audiences generally see through journalists who try to do that, as we generally see on social media platforms like Twitter, where, you know, journalists get called out almost every other day in South Africa.
Thanks for that, Miss Andisa. And I'm going to come to Annie. Please introduce yourself. And we are going on a protest for elections. What's the Africa Women in Tech? What are they going to be doing?
My name is Annie Afe. I'm founder of African Women in Technology. I'm a serial entrepreneur. So we also have a blog that we usually will use to cover news events such as this. So say, for example, with Nigeria, we had to search out who the correct sources were, who were actually participating, and where we could get that information and then share it. So that's one of the things that we do. As the elections approach, we try to search for us who are not necessarily always on the ground. We try to search out who we know that have been trusted trusted sources as it comes to information, just because we do want to make sure that the information is accurate, and we want to make sure that we're not influencing one way or the other. You try to stay as neutral as you can, so that this way you can be looked upon as a source. So when it comes to the women, they do reach out and tell us what's going on, and tell us also who we should be paying attention to, and who is going to bring them the most information. So for us, it's a matter of staying neutral, but also making sure that we get the correct information so that we can put it out and then support the women that are involved in anything that's happening on the ground.
Thanks for that, Annie. I'm coming to you, Jim Smart. You've been here since the beginning. I'm wondering what your thoughts are on the discussion thus far.
As a journalist, what are you doing during protests? It's such a difficult thing, this objectivity thing that, you know, journalism has to deal with and contend with, simply because, you know, there's two sides and you're trying to tell these other sort of textual stories, like what really is happening in this protest and why are people on the streets, obviously. And usually I feel sometimes in questions like what you're dealing with today is journalism is operating in a sort of outdated toolbox, set of toolbox that the political sides and, you know, everyone else who's on this other side of pushing things has really advanced from for a very long time. So they know how to move around and, you know, make sure that you make sure that all the journalists who are reporting on issues, number one, the public knows who they are, number one, or, you know, you try on Twitter to say these people are not objective or that sort of thing. And you put this sort of like a straitjacket that if a journalist fails, if there's a typo in your story, if a story that you did either has one part of it that is not correct or whatever it is, and you latch on it. And essentially is this perfect way on how to dismiss and disregard storytellers. And it's a concept that has been done over a period of time. And so the audience keeps losing faith over and over again on particular journalists on very flimsy grounds, that they interviewed someone and they didn't ask one question. So it's not a full body of work, really. It's just that, you know, this thing that people keep demanding, that journalism has to be perfect, and it's not. It cannot be. Journalism, like anything, is a practice, and we make mistakes and we fail, like everyone says. You know, well, doctors bury their mistakes. Journalists publish our mistakes, right? And so in this sense, then I think one of the things that perhaps we need to reclaim is the ability for being human and doing things and accepting when you fail, you know, making apologies and saying, you know, we were wrong when we got it wrong, and moving forward and trying to tell the story as it is. Because in the end, this thing is about storytelling. It's about reclaiming the true story, the truth. Really, and really the question of objectivity or neutrality doesn't arise if there's truth. And I always side with the truth.
And maybe just to follow up on that with Bonnie, has the style and form of, you know, protest changed? Because, you know, in this room, I don't see anybody ready to go out on the street to, you know, to be at a protest. We maybe prefer to do the professional paperwork, whatever it is. We prefer to cover the story, but ideally to convene a protest and go out on the streets. Is that a problem? And maybe do we need to, you know, sort of redefine our own ways of, you know, dissent?
So every journalist was spoken and every artist was spoken, actually, they're all protesters in their own way. When Aseda does his songs, he's actually protesting. When Namu does his stories, Matt Doe is protesting. When Wamadai does his blogs, protesting. When I need a platform to go and speak about the issues that I actually care about, they give me a platform. So that's a way of supporting protesters and the civic space. Remember this, there would be no multi-party democracy in this country without the media. The media played a critical role in getting us multi-party democracy. Some of the poor were detained during the 80s and 90s by Moi and tortured were journalists and writers. So they play a very critical role in advancing democracy and defending the civic space. The other thing, if you look at Gado actually is a daily protester through his cartoons and is doing civic education. So let's not try and frame protest as just a placard or being in the streets. So a protest does not mean that you have a placard or you've been tear gassed or getting arrested. You can protest in your own way. If you're a lawyer and you represent protesters, you're playing your civic duty. So let's define protest and defining civic space as being an active citizen. And being an active citizen means that you, whatever you do, whether you're a doctor, a lawyer, a teacher, a street vendor, a cleaner, in your role as a citizen, you're doing what you're supposed to do to advance and defend human rights and uproot it. So, in conclusion, we are all playing an important role in whatever spaces that we're in. But a journalist must be biased in his work. He must be biased towards truth, justice, equality, equity, transparency, honesty. And so journalists must always lean on the side of truth and justice.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Africa Law Tech Podcast. Make sure to follow us on Spotify and share this podcast with your friends. This podcast is hosted by The Lawyers Hub. The Lawyers Hub works on digital policy and legal innovation. To find out more about The Lawyers Hub, kindly visit lawyershub.org and africalawtech.com.